From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. The government today put out new rules on vaccines for American workers. For more than 100 million private sector employees, they have to be fully vaccinated in 2 months. The deadline is January 4th. White House officials say this will charge up the economy, but as we know, there is backlash. Attorneys general in about 24 states are threatening to sue. Let's talk about this with Ali Velshi. He's MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, there are actually two rules here. Yeah, help us understand them.
Yeah, two different rules. One applies to companies, private companies, with more than 100 employees or more. In those companies, workers have to be fully vaccinated by January 4th or get a negative COVID test every week. That's 84 million workers. Now, the government had already mandated federal workers and federal contractors. These are now private companies. The second rule applies to healthcare workers at any facility that gets Medicare or Medicaid funding. They also either have to be fully vaccinated by January 4th, and there will be no exceptions for them, no option for weekly testing. That's another 17 million workers. So we're talking about 100 million workers all around here.
Now, I understand these workers would get paid time off to get their shots, and the shots are free. What happens to workers, and we know this will happen, right, who say no to vaccines, no to testing?
Generally speaking, these are going to be administered by OSHA. They're OSHA rules. And the way it's set up is not actually as a mandate. It's a you have an avoidable risk in your workplace, and you have to make sure that you can avoid that risk. So if you can say everybody works at home, for instance, or people who aren't vaccinated or don't agree to testing can work from home, that's the way around it. But generally speaking, if you are not able to figure out a way to keep your workplace safe and people don't get vaccinated and don't agree to tests, they will lose their jobs.
Okay. Now, healthcare workers, you mentioned them, they don't have a testing option, and the only choice is to get inoculated. If they don't comply by January 4, are they out of a job?
Yes. Until now, healthcare workers who had been, you know, told by their companies to get vaccinated by a certain date, what would happen is they would be put on unpaid leave as of that date and then given an extended period of time. Kaiser Permanente did that, for instance. They gave them an extra month to get vaccinated if they wanted to change their mind, after which they'd be terminated. Now, because of the power of the fact that this is a decision taken by the administration, these healthcare workers will lose their jobs after January 4th, unless there's something in the works, an appeal on the basis of religious exemption or some discussion. But if you literally just thumb your nose at the requirement, you'll be out of a job.
All right. Now, Ali, is there, I guess stepping back, is there evidence that vaccine mandates actually work to get more shots into more arms?
Yes, but I'm not 100% sure whether it's vaccine mandates or it's the financial incentive. So, for instance, United Airlines was the first company to do this. They're at 98% vaccinated. Delta has not mandated vaccine, but it said if you don't get vaccinated, it'll cost you $250 a month extra in your health care. And that has actually gotten them up, not to United levels, but to very, very high levels. So the financial penalty involved, whether there's an actual fine, higher insurance, or losing your job, which, you know, as we know, we think of as a financial penalty, that seems to work. Without the mandates, we had about up to 70% vaccination rates generally in that neighborhood. With these things, we're getting into the high 90s. So whether one likes it or not, they do seem to be having an impact.
Okay, and one quick minute. There is opposition in Republican-led states. Attorneys general are threatening to sue in court. So what's the upshot here? Will this potentially get tied up in court, or do you think the deadline is going to stick?
It could, but because it's not actually written as a mandate, it's written as a way to prevent exposure to a work hazard. The administration has been careful to make this as litigation-proof as they can. That doesn't mean it's not going to get sued. It's going to show up in court, but the bottom line is it may become moot because most people will have been vaccinated by the time this gets to a court, unless there's an emergency injunction or something.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thanks as always.
Thanks, Scott.
Let's go to the Supreme Court now, where we're getting signals that justices may be willing to broaden the rights of Americans to carry guns. Now, New York is one of 8 states that bans so-called concealed carry, and this case could determine whether that state can ban people from carrying concealed weapons in public without a special license. And, of course, if that ban falls in New York, would it fall in the 8 others? NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson is following the case. Carrie, you listened to oral arguments yesterday. Can you just lay out some of the issues here?
The central issue, Robin, is whether the New York law, which requires people to demonstrate a specific need to carry a gun in public in order to get a license, whether that law is too restrictive. The lawyer for the gun owners in this case says the Second Amendment right to bear arms is a fundamental constitutional right, and the government can't go around putting strict restrictions on people. But he did leave some room for regulation of guns in what the court has called previously sensitive places. Now, the lawyer for New York says this law is needed for public safety, and she says there's a long history of gun regulations in that state and elsewhere in the U.S., dating back to before the time the United States was its own country.
And you say, you know, certain places. Well, Chief Justice John Roberts and the court's three liberal justices pressed lawyer Paul Clement, who's representing the challengers to the ban, on how to decide which public spaces should allow these concealed guns. Justice Stephen Breyer wondered, does this mean guns could be allowed anywhere alcohol is served? Let's listen.
I think that people of good moral character who start drinking a lot and who may be there for a football game or some kind of soccer game can get pretty angry at each other. And if they each have a concealed weapon, who knows?
Carrie, what was the response to that? Or tell us more about that exchange and maybe others like it from that side of the bench.
Yeah, this is a very complicated issue, and it's not clear the Supreme Court, when it rules, is going to get into all of these ins and outs. The justices, those appointed by Democratic presidents like Justice Breyer and Republican presidents, kind of were going around and around and around about where to draw the lines on sensitive places. Does that mean university campuses, football and baseball games, in the subway late at night in New York City? It's hard to draw those lines. Paul Clement, the lawyer for the gun owners, didn't really want to draw those lines. And it may be that the court decides to duck that issue when it rules later this term.
Well, meanwhile, the court's conservative majority seemed to indicate they would rule to overturn this New York law. How so?
Yeah, we heard a number of difficult questions from the conservative majority, especially three of the justices appointed by former President Donald Trump, many of whom, all of whom, were endorsed by the National Rifle Association as part of their confirmation process. Many of those justices, including Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, have been on record in their time on the lower courts seeking to strike down gun restrictions. And they believe that we should look to history and text that they seem to suggest indicates that certain gun regs on the books now do not offer enough protection involving what they consider to be a fundamental constitutional right, the right to bear arms for self-defense. The key question in this case is, how far does that apply when you leave your house and go into the public square?
Well, and talk more about that. How does the Second Amendment apply to this notion, which is carrying guns in public concealed? You know, what does it say?
You know, we don't know. Mm-hmm. The jurisprudence on the Second Amendment is relatively young. Robin, remember, it was only 2008 when the late Justice Scalia found for the court majority that there was a right to bear arms inside the house as an individual in the process of self-defense. But since that time, the court has largely ducked any of these major questions. That's why so many people are watching this New York case and for what it would mean for New York and for people in about 80 million people in other states, states like Maryland and California, Rhode Island, New Jersey, and others that have these kinds of strict gun license regulations on the books now.
Yeah. Carrie, we have a couple minutes here. So while we have you, you know, yes, there are those eight other states that already have these, you know, bans on carrying concealed weapons without a license. This case obviously is going to affect those other states as well. Either way, the justices rule, and it sounds as if they're going to be ruling against a ban on that kind of carriage. But is the court deciding any other gun laws? I mean, what else is in the ether?
Yeah, this is the major Second Amendment case on the docket this term, Robin. But you know, this is one of the most controversial series of disputes that the court is going to hear this term. We've got two blockbuster cases on abortion. We heard one recently involving the Justice Department's ability to sue and abortion providers' ability to sue in Texas. We've got that other case coming up December 1st in Mississippi on that state's very restrictive abortion ban. So this is going to be a big, big term for the Supreme Court. Lots of people watching not only what they're going to do on the Second Amendment, but also abortion and other key issues coming down the pike.
Well, and Carrie, not just watching, but listening. just, you know, from the point of view of a longtime court watcher, What's it been like to actually hear the voices as we can all hear them?
It is so important, Robin, from a transparency perspective. Advocates have been pushing for a long time for the court to open itself up to cameras. That does not seem likely at this point, but because of the coronavirus pandemic, we're able to listen to live audio now. And I think it really helps the public understand what happens in these cases and the business of the court in a way that is very, very healthy from a First Amendment and a public policy perspective, too.
And with just a few seconds left, when might the justices decide on this gun case?
You know, they tend to save the hardest for last. The court term typically ends in June, so I don't expect a ruling on this case before next year at the earliest.
Okay. NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
Question, if you bake, is there anything new under the sun? And while we're on the subject, aren't there enough cookbooks out there? Well, no, not if you're missing Dory Greenspan's new one. Words like superlative and delightful are sprinkled through reviews the way, oh, look, she sprinkled those pistachios on top of that apricot olive oil cake. Dory Greenspan is a 5-time James Beard Award winner, a columnist for the New York Times, the writer of 13 prior cookbooks, and now the author of Baking with Dory, a coconut milk chocolate cake, a double-decker salted caramel cake, or how about maple miso bread and the savory, that tomato tart, and the clam chowder pie? Get out of town. Dory Greenspan joins us now by Zoom. Welcome.
I can barely say hello. You just made me smile and giggle.
Well,
thank you.
That's what your book does for us. It makes us smile. And you said when you had done 13, you were finished, Baker's Dozen. Then someone mentioned you should do a savory book. What did that immediately mean to you?
You're right. Baker's Dozen sounded just right for a baker. I had this cheddar scone in Santa Barbara. I put it up on Instagram. My friend DM'd me and said, you should write a savory baking book. And I got all tingly. I thought, yes, this is what I'm going to do. But the more I worked on the book, the sweeter it got. Mm. And so there is a savory baking chapter. It's called Salty Side Up. But there are an awful lot of sweets in this book. I just can't help myself.
Well, and how does it happen? I mean, does miso and maple just like come to you in a fever dream?
So ideas come from everywhere. I had a fever dream once that produced a great cookie. But the miso maple loaf, it sounds strange, but I made a roasted salmon that had miso and maple. And I was tasting the glaze and I was thinking, miso and maple, it could be a cake. Sometimes it just happens like that. It's unexpected. I love when there's a surprise in something. And the miso and maple kind of teeter-totter between sweet and savory. So the cake is glazed with apricot jam, but you could have it with cheddar cheese.
Well, and what I love is at the end of each recipe, you have a little note called playing around. Like, here's the fig and goat cheese tart. Oh, my goodness. You can use cream cheese softened for the filling, or ricotta, or a lime, or a scallion. You give people choices instead of goat cheese in that case. Or for the strawberry cheesecake chocolate no-bake pie, you say, try soft fruits, raspberries, blackberries, sliced bananas, small pieces of pineapple. Play around.
I sometimes teasingly call myself an evangelist for home bakers. I want everyone to have the pleasure of baking, and I don't want people to be stopped because they open their fridge and they don't have exactly the fruit that I used, or they don't really like cinnamon. They'd rather use ginger or cardamom. So I love to give people options.
What I love is that you give us hope, because it's not as if you had a mother at whose knee you watched everything she did, and so you got a jump start on everybody else. Your mother used the oven to store boxes of cookies.
She did. True. Crackers, too. Yes.
And you didn't go to culinary school. You learned by baking.
I learned from cookbooks. I was married as a junior in college, and I hadn't cooked, I hadn't baked, but I wanted to. I wanted to have people come to our place and sit around our table. And so I taught myself to do this and discovered that I loved it.
But you just threw me back in time to college, my college boyfriend. I was going to make my own tomato sauce for spaghetti, and I left the top off the pot. And by the time I went back to serve my simmered spaghetti sauce, it was just a black thing at the bottom of the pot. What do you say to people who are standing there with, you know, it just didn't work, it falls, it doesn't work, whatever it is?
Do it again. Try it again. Try something else. You know, the thing about baking, unlike burnt tomato sauce, is that most baking failures taste pretty good. You learn by doing. Learn to enjoy the process, to take pleasure in the way the ingredients look, the way they smell, the way in baking you see transformation at every stage. And pay attention. Write in your cookbooks next time you want to put chocolate in instead of vanilla, whatever it is.
Can you think of some combinations that after 13 cookbooks, this is your 14th, hit you for the first time?
Well, certainly miso maple. Using star anise, ground star anise in a cookie. So it's a spice cookie, but you really taste the star anise. And I loved doing that spice that I use often in Asian cooking. I use it with beef. But here, giving it a star roll in a cookie makes you think, oh, I thought I knew what this cookie would taste like. And surprise, it's something new. It's like taking the babka recipe. There's a chocolate babka in the book, which is, you know, pretty traditional. But I'm looking at the dough, which is this beautiful brioche dough. And I thought, could be savory, could be filled with cheese, could have streusel on top that's not sweet. Mm-hmm. Even the goat cheese and fig tart had a little acidity in it that I hadn't thought to put in a tart like that before. Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I love the sentence, I thought I knew that cookie. but I'm looking at the madeleines, tea and honey madeleines.
Right? Yeah. I mean, we think of madeleines as being what we would have with tea. Why not put the tea right in there? Oh, and I am obsessed with the dough that you use to make gougère, which are French cheese puffs, because it's the same dough you use to make cream puffs or profiterole. I make gougère. They're like my signature dish. I make the dough. I make little balls of the puffs. I put them in the freezer. And then when you come to my house, I put them in the oven right before you come. And I greet you at the door with warm gougère and wine. And I've been making these for years. So this time I decided to make them with Gouda, which I had never done before, and to add cumin seeds. And that was fun. And then I looked at them and I thought, you know, they don't have to be round. They don't have to be cheese puffs. They could be sticks. And if you make them long, the texture changes because you get more of the crusty part. And I thought, wow, same dough that I've been using forever, new way of using it.
Yep. And I'm looking at the playing around for that. Add a couple pinches of herbs or chop fresh rosemary or sprinkle some finely chopped walnuts on top of the puffs or sticks before baking them. Just great. Listen, are you finished, do you think? I mean, this is 14. What do you think?
Can you trust me if I say I'm finished? There are always new things. You know, I work with Julia Child. And one day we played hooky. Julia's idea of hooky was, let's go to the supermarket. And we were in the parking lot. And she said to me, you know, we're so lucky because we work in food. And I kind of looked at her and she said, it means we'll never stop learning. There's always something that will spark an idea. I don't know that I'll do another book. My husband, you know, I'm working on a newsletter now, so I have a place to put new recipes, but I'm still writing down everything. So I don't know.
Yeah. As we head into the holidays, you have a section of this book called Just So You Know, Some Do's and Don'ts. Can you give us a couple?
Anytime you pick up a new cookbook, whether it's mine or somebody else's, I think you should look through it and see if you can find out how the author measures flour, what kind of butter he or she is using, what size are the eggs. Everybody works on recipes in their own way, and you're going to get better results if you do what the author did. I like to weigh flour, but I measure it the way Julia did. Scoop and swoop is what she used to say. I use fine sea salt, a A lot of people use kosher salt. It's good to find out ahead of time. Hmm. One of the things that always seems to be an issue is preheating the oven. Look at when you're going to need the oven. Give yourself about a half hour for that oven to preheat. Even when it goes ding, 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 I'm ready for you, it probably needs a few more minutes.
Huh.
The oven is your friend, and you need to make it your best friend. You need to know everything about your oven. So when I'm working in a new oven, I'll toast coconut in it. So I'll put some coconut on a baking sheet, and I'll watch it and see, is it browning more in the back left-hand corner than it is in the right-hand corner? And I'll get a sense of where my oven's hot spots are and then work around them. So I may rotate my pan because I know that that back left-hand corner is hotter. Do what's called a mise en place, a putting in place. Measure out all of your ingredients. Line them up as though you were on the Great British Bake Off. Get everything in order so that if the phone rings, if the doorbell rings, if you're just distracted by something, you can come back and see where you are. Put your ingredients in the order in which you're going to use them.
And you don't skip something.
Or you'll find out, you know, read the recipe. You read it twice so that you don't find out in the middle of it that, oh, I was supposed to have buttermilk. I don't have buttermilk.
Are you talking to me? Because that's happened. Dori Greenspan, what a pleasure to speak with you. We're going to have some of the recipes at hereandnow.org. And, you know, even if you don't make them, just the reading of them is such a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Robin. And I can have my oven preheated and my gougère ready for you anytime. Let me know.
We are a train right away. Thank you so much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Opening arguments are set to begin tomorrow in the trial of three white men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery, a black man, while he jogged in Georgia last year. Travis McMichael, his father Gregory McMichael, are accused of killing Arbery. William Bryan, who taped the deadly shooting, is also facing a murder charge. They're claiming they thought he was a burglar. And in a bit of a shock, of the 12 jurors who've been seated for this trial, 11 are white. Only one is black in a county that is a quarter black. Defense attorneys eliminated all but one of the prospective black jurors yesterday. And when the prosecuting attorneys protested that they were removed because of their race, the judge agreed with them but didn't reinstate any of the black jurors. Lisa Hagen is a reporter for member station WABE. And Lisa, heads, you know, are being scratched right now. In a trial so directly about racial justice, how did only one black juror get seated? Take us through.
Yeah, so you know, you said the judge agreed that what the judge actually agreed was that there was in fact a disproportionate number of white people and black people on the jury pool, but he basically had to go through and review the reasons that the defense had for each one of the black potential jurors for striking them. And because they were able to come up with non-race-based reasons for their decisions, the judge decided he couldn't force any changes to the jury.
Yeah. What were some of the reasons?
You know, this has been an issue for not just black people, but a lot of the jurors we've seen come through. You know, this is a super high profile case, and a lot of people have seen the video mm-hmm. and long made up their minds about this. So that's the kind of thing we've been hearing from a lot of people, which is like, yeah, they're guilty.
And what have you been hearing from Arbery's family and from racial justice advocates?
Yeah, Marcus Arbery Sr., Ahmaud's dad, apparently audibly gasped in court yesterday when the prosecutor pointed out the disproportionate number of Black folks on the jury. And we also heard from Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, who said she was glad the jury selection process was finally over, although she was certainly disheartened by what it looked like.
Well,
I think you can just see there how tired his family already is of this process.
And it's just started. Well, one of the accused attorneys, the defense attorney, Kevin Goh, I believe it's pronounced, told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution he actually thought the jury wasn't diverse enough on the white side. He said he wanted more Bubba's or Joe Sixpacks, white men without a college education. What more is the defense saying after the jury selection?
Yeah, that's Kevin Goff. He's an interesting character. I don't believe he actually filed that motion. It was just sort of an offhand comment that he didn't follow up with any sort of documentation. But of course, you know, what we're likely to hear from defense attorneys in the case is that they are arguing that the McMichaels were trying to effect a citizen's arrest, which was legal in the time in Georgia. That they ended up shooting Ahmaud Arbery in self-defense. That's the argument we're going to hear.
All right. Well, tomorrow the jury will be sworn in. Opening statements will start. We will be coming back to you, Lisa Hagan, reporter with member station WABE. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
More than 40 countries have pledged to phase out coal-fired power by 2050.
Today, I think we can say that the end of coal is in sight.
That is Alok Sharma, president of the COP26 summit in Glasgow, Scotland. But major coal producers and burners, the U.S., China, Australia, have not signed on. For more, we're joined by Umair Irfan, climate reporter for Vox, and he's in Washington. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Umair, what's in this plan? I gather some countries will go off coal sooner than others?
Yeah, that's right. So this is a commitment to phasing out domestic use of coal. The goalpost is for wealthier countries to phase out somewhere in the 2030s, and for some of the poorer countries and developing countries to decline by the 2040s. The idea is that with the current fleet of coal-fired power plants, they will eventually age out of the power distribution fleet and over time will be replaced by cleaner sources of energy.
Now, here's the thing. The largest users of coal, China and then India and then the U.S., have not signed on to this. Is there kind of a signal here?
That's right. You know, it shows that these countries are still counting on coal both for a major source of domestic production but also for exports. You know, Australia, for instance, did sign on to a net zero emissions target, but if you look at their target, they say that they expect to continue exporting coal to other countries well into the 2050s. And it just kind of shows that incongruence here that, you know, while they do acknowledge that they want to zero out their emissions, they're also still saying that it's really hard to transition when you're a major economy and you still need a lot of energy.
Well, one other, problem here appears to be the timing. The influential International Energy Agency has this climate roadmap to what's called net zero, and that requires the whole world to be coal-free by 2040.
Yeah, that's right. You know, coal is the largest single source of greenhouse gas emissions because it's a very energy-dense fossil fuel, and, you know, it produces a whole lot of other pollution. And so the idea is if you target coal and zero it out first, you can make some of the biggest gains. And those gains have to start right away because if you want to limit warming in line with the targets of the Paris Agreement, those cuts have to start now. And that's much harder when you're not putting definite targets in the near term. You know, it's one thing to set your benchmarks in the 2030s and 2040s, but what's really going to be significant in these COP negotiations is what they set out to do over the next 5 and 10 years, and that remains to be seen.
Now, for the countries that have signed on, Vietnam, Indonesia, Poland, Canada, they're significant users of coal because in much of the world, it's a cheap fuel to make electricity. This can't be easy. How will they make this switch?
I mean, it's going to take time. You know, a lot of these countries, you noted, you know, many of them are developing countries or don't have very strong economies. And so they're counting on some international finance. They want some of the wealthier countries that have historically produced the most greenhouse gas emissions to chip in to help finance renewable energy and take other steps. And so there's a fair amount of horse trading that still has to happen in order to make this work out.
Yeah. And you mentioned the mining and exporting of coal by Australia. Tell me a little bit more about that side of it and whether there's any movement on restricting mining. I imagine if less coal is mined in the world, it's more scarce, the price goes up, and that might make it easier for countries to transition off of coal.
That's true, but at the same time, if the price of coal goes up, it becomes a much more lucrative export, and so that's the other economic force you have to work against. And it's not just Australia. You know, countries like Saudi Arabia, for instance, they've also set a net zero target, but they're also counting on exporting oil. And even before this COP summit, you know, the United States was leaning on OPEC, the oil-producing cartel, to produce more oil to help boost the global economy. A lot of countries still realize that they need cheap fossil fuels in the near term to keep their economies growing, particularly as we emerge from the COVID-19 pandemic. But at the same time, they also acknowledge that, you know, there's a huge price to pay environmentally. That's really going to be one of the big thorny issues that has to be settled at these negotiations.
And can I ask you about one other announcement today from the summit? The U.S. was part of this. The U.S. and other countries agreed to phase out the overseas financing of fossil fuel use. Significant?
Yeah, it is. Because, you know, while in wealthier countries like the United States and even the European Union, emissions have been flat or have even declined slightly as they've transitioned from coal toward renewables and natural gas, much of the growth in greenhouse gas emissions is occurring in developing countries. And that's happening because export and development banks in wealthy countries are financing coal-fired power plants, which commits them to using fossil fuels for decades. But recently, many of these coal financiers and these fossil fuel financiers have agreed to stop doing that, including China. They announced this at the UN General Assembly earlier this year. So blocking this international finance of coal helps close off a critical route that allows for more coal plants to keep being built. So eventually, the ones that are currently there will be shut down.
Yeah. And finally, Umair, this summit wraps up in a few days. How do you think it ends?
Well, we've already seen some significant announcements at this summit. You know, we saw India, for instance, commit to zeroing out its greenhouse gas emissions. That was something of a surprise. But some of the big issues about financing, particularly how developing countries that are going to be impacted by climate change in the near term and over the long term should be compensated, that's going to be a lot more thorny and much more difficult to resolve. How much money actually gets committed and how it's actually distributed, that's something that a lot of negotiators are going to be spending a lot of time on. And it's not clear that they'll come to a resolution by the end of next week.
Umair Irfan is a climate reporter for Vox. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Now to the Midwest, historically the breadbasket of America. These days, though, we'd venture to guess more kids know about TikTok than livestock. And that is why some schools are adding farm work to classwork. Students are building chicken coops and sheep pens right next to their playgrounds. Katie Pikus of Harvest Public Media reports from Iowa.
Welcome to Chicken Town!
Students at Marnie Simons Elementary in Hamburg in southwest Iowa spend a lot of time doing chores on the school's mini farm. On this day, the children help farm school coordinator Spencer Baldwin trim the chickens' wings.
Okay, we'll spread that out. Bam, bam. See, doesn't even care.
Baldwin's teaching about a dozen kindergarten through middle school students that clipping chickens' wings will keep them from flying over the fence. The small Iowa school district has 50 chickens, 4 sheep, 3 goats, and 2 piglets. Students learn the basics of livestock anatomy and diet. But Baldwin says there's a larger lesson.
The biggest thing the kids learn is just how to treat the animals, how to interact with them. You know, especially these little kids, my kindergartners out here, when we were first out here, they like to run and chase me, you know, and they don't mean anything by it. They just want to be around them. They want to pet them and want to snuggle them.
But Baldwin says the younger kids quickly learned not to stress the animals by chasing them. The older children, like fifth grader Kayla McIntosh, put in some real farm work. She wants to help deliver the sheep's babies this spring.
I've never lived on a farm, so I actually want to experience it.
Most kids in the town of 1,100 people don't live on a farm, but the majority of Hamburg students participate in farm school. And some teachers say it's affected their classes in a good way. First grade teacher Michelle Hendrickson says her students gravitate towards reading books about farm animals.
They do dive into the farm animals and want to learn more about the chickens, and more so the animals that we've had on the farm have sparked an interest in their reading.
She says her students have become more productive because they're eager to finish tasks so they can help out on the farm. Hamburg Superintendent Mike Wells says the farm teaches children a work ethic, and maintaining a farm at a school is a lot of work.
First of all, on weekends, who takes care of the animals? You have to set up a system of kids who are dependable to come in and feed and take care of the animals.
Wells says if someone doesn't lock up the chickens at night, raccoons or possums could kill them. This is the farm school's fifth year. It started after a group of students incubated some chicken eggs. Those eggs became chicks that grew up and needed a home. Students had to get special permission from the city council because local laws forbid livestock in town.
All these buildings out here were built by kids. They're not perfect, but it was their design and they built it.
A few other Iowa schools have small farm schools too. The number of farms in the U.S. is decreasing, and as fewer children help raise livestock, people fall out of touch with where their food comes from. Natalie Carroll is a professor of agricultural science, education, and communication at Purdue University. She says a school farm can help make city kids understand farm life.
Our food doesn't just come from the store. It doesn't just show up magically. And they gain an appreciation for how much it takes to raise food, the choices that have to be made.
That's an important lesson at Hamburg's farm school. The piglets, the kids call them breakfast and lunch, will be slaughtered at the end of the school year. Farm school coordinator Spencer Baldwin says that topic will come up.
It can be a tough lesson to learn, but it's a good thing to learn, especially in an agricultural community here. You know, a lot of them have been exposed to that.
Baldwin says a few of the younger children get emotional, but the older kids help them through. Even those tough lessons feed into a hands-on education in agriculture, all part of a window into farm life for young children. For Here and Now, I'm Katie Pikus.
California condors are gorgeous birds, 10-foot wingspans, black feathers. In 1983, there were just 22 left after being hunted, poisoned. Then biologists bred them in captivity, keeping track of who fathered whom in their stud book. But recently, they discovered two born without any genetic input from dad. Wow, an immaculate conception. Oliver Ryder is director of conservation genetics at the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. Oliver, first tell us more about these birds.
They're truly magnificent, and if you find a birder's guide that says, like, what bird you can confuse this bird with, you know, to help you sort out possibilities, right. They say that condors are mostly confused with airplanes. They fly at very high altitudes, have acute vision, can fly hundreds of miles without flapping their wings. They're quintessentially adapted to be creatures of the wind.
Wow, wow, what a treat. How did scientists discover this? What did you see in the testing of the DNA of the condors that made you think, wait a second, what have we got here?
In normal reproduction in vertebrate animals, an offspring gets one copy of chromosomes from mother and one copy of chromosomes from father. In these two chicks, the male that was in with the female who laid the egg from which they hatched could not have been the father. And yet that same male and female had reproduced previously and produced a number of chicks. So what's up with that? Well, if you look more closely, you see those chicks are genetically uniform. From their mother's chromosomes, they picked one copy and it was duplicated. So they have no paternal contribution and they're remarkably genetically uniform across their chromosomes. And in birds, that's a signal. And if they are males, that really points to the direction that they are produced by parthenogenetic development, that they had no male contribution.
Parthenogenesis. This is an egg developing into an embryo without being fertilized by a sperm. It can happen in other species, but that's the thinking here, that that's what happened.
Well, and actually this is the first case of it being proven with genetic data in a bird species. And the data are very robust. The conclusion is inescapable that these birds don't have a male contribution. And that's basically the definition of parthenogenesis.
What was your first feeling when this was becoming obvious?
Well, it was a kind of an aha moment. You know, one thinks of Archimedes, Eureka. It was like, I still get goosebumps when I think about it because it was just, it so much did not match expectations. We so much did not expect this. And yet it was such a startling understanding, insight, appreciation that this possibility of parthenogenesis perfectly explained the data that we had.
Well, what do we know about the two condors who hatched and had somewhat short lives, I understand? I mean, were they impacted in any way negatively? Because obviously, this is something that, as you're trying to save this species, this is something that could, you know, maybe be used.
Well, exactly, Robin. We know that they died before reproducing. With only two cases, it's very hard to draw generalizations. But what we do know is that if they had lethal genes, they wouldn't have appeared. So in some way, they must represent birds that have that don't have representation of the most kind of deleterious mutations that could be present in condor populations. Remember that this is the first case of facultative parthenogenesis that's been developed. And previously, all cases of parthenogenesis in birds were discovered because females were housed separately from males.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, this bird you and others are trying to save from extinction. But you never would have made this discovery if they'd gone extinct.
That's, of course, very true. I mean, to me, as a geneticist, it's really this exquisite set of information that we have about a species, because we have samples from all the condors, you know, since the founding population that was brought out of the wild, and that are the ancestors of all condors present today and will be the ancestors of all condors into the future. And this is a really unprecedented set of genetic information and genealogical profiles that will be useful for managing the sustainability of California condor populations and ensuring the preservation of their gene pool.
Oliver, what do they feel like or sound like when they fly, you know, anywhere near you?
Ah, that's a nice question. They make a whooshing noise, you know. So one of the biggest memories is when I was present at a condor release. There were many condors around, and they would fly overhead, you know, maybe 20 feet over your head or something like that. And of course, a big bird like that attracts your attention. It's a whoosh.
Lovely. Oliver Ryder, Director of Conservation Genetics at the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. Thank you and best of luck.
Thank you, Robin.
A whoosh. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now.